Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And remember to click that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you, because aboard the mothership is Michael Chase Walker. We discuss the creation of his classic animated film, The Last Unicorn. Now come aboard as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Walker. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's a great honor of mine. Me and my wife are big fans of The Last Unicorn, so thank you so much for talking with us.
That's great.
So I always start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired your love for film, and who were your earliest influences?
Well, interestingly enough, I grew up in the television industry, if you will. My mother was a Miss Rheingold and runner-up to Miss America. She was a famous model and actress of her time in Manhattan. And my family were very successful clothiers in Manhattan as well. So they ran with a very fast crowd, Mitch Miller, Paul Newman, Marilyn Monroe.
Oh,
those
wow.
Who you could expect to see at their guest parties. I mean, Clint Walker. Bob Duval, as a young actor, used to come over at cocktail parties and play the washing machine game, where he would sit on top of the washing machine and bang his feet, imitate Johnny Mathis. Gosh, just so many. So we grew up very starstruck, I suppose. And also, you know, it was the time of the great television movies as well, on the early show and the midnight movies and the late show. And so we just watched the string of probably some of the greatest films of all time, mostly black and white. Mighty Joe Young, Gunga Din. So, you know, it was just movies. And then, you know, then we'd stop. You know, if you were watching television and all, you, there was mom taking a bath on television.
That's funny.
So I suppose that all started. And I always had this sort of preternatural memory for films as well. I mean, you know, my whole life. So it was that combined with also a very early love of mythology.
Mm. So, I mean, some of the names you mentioned, like Paul Newman, Duvall, I mean, they're legendary names. So, I mean, did you spend time around them as well as your mother spent time around them? And what did you learn about people in that level of stratosphere?
Well, I was, you know, I was starstruck. I mean, we would go for, you know, the weekend at Milton Green, and Milton Green, the photographer, was my, Amy Green was my godmother. Milton was making The Prince and the Showgirl at the time, and also a dear family friend, as well as Sis Corman. So I remember going up to their estate in Weston, Connecticut, and there'd be Anouk Ami and Pierre Barreau having an affair at the guest house, and so you look out the window, and there they were, sort of ambling romantically across the estate lawn. So it was more of an assimilation, I guess. I grew up in thinking that I was as big a movie star as they were. And it was true, too. I was just walking down the street with my mother, who was a great, great beauty and very famous at the time. And, you know, the cab drivers would, like, drive up on the sidewalk. And, of course, whenever we went to dinner at P.J. Clark's or Schraff's, you know, we were treated like royalty. So,
Well, one thing, as I was doing some research on you, if my information is correct, you have an amazing background. I read that you graduated from the Australian Conservatory, where you studied comparative mythology and Eastern philosophy. Is that true?
Correct. Yes. And so, also the Bombay Institute in India.
Where you study Vedic literature and Indian history.
Yes.
I mean, that is an amazing, unique background. So how did all that stuff, the mythology, studying mythology, philosophy, Vedic studies, all that lead to you or put you on the path that you're on or that you ended up on?
As I said, it was very early, early, early. I remember absolutely being awestruck by my mother, and there are famous photographs taken by, you know, some great photographers who would come over and do photo shoots, because I often acted. We did, oh gosh, you know, Naked City. We did television shows, commercials, Vicks Vapor Rub. And that coupled with my mother and reading from the Childcraft Encyclopedia, so where I'd learned all of the great myths and was utterly fascinated. So it was just sort of an amalgam of growing up and then trying to understand the basis of mythology and storytelling that was has been a lifelong passion of mine since as early as I can remember.
So is there something universal about mythology, of at least mythical stories, that allow them to survive for hundreds and sometimes thousands of years?
Oh, yeah. I think it's at the very core of evolutionary psychology that, you know, there are not just core archetypal stories, but and figures, characters, but there's also a very connectable genesis from even Neanderthalian beliefs as they developed and grew into the Neolithic period of mythology and storytelling, into the Bronze Age, Iron Ages, and it's been a lifetime pursuit of mine is to draw those connections and to trace that development in genesis from the earliest yearnings of human consciousness. And I think that all came to a head too, because I also lived with Timothy Leary for 3 years and studied with him. And, you know, and he was friends with Alan Watts and Ralph Metzner and Laura Huxley, Aldous's wife. And so I was surrounded by them and deeply, deeply influenced between the nexus of storytelling and the development of human consciousness and awareness.
Now, for people like me who don't know, what is Vedic studies?
Vedic studies is the study of the Vedas, Vedic literatures, the Rig Veda, the four Vedas themselves, and all of the Bhagavatams and the Mahabharata and the early Sanskrit literatures of India.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, what inspired you to even go to Australia and then Bombay to do these studies? I mean, did you always know this is the direction you wanted to go in?
No, it happened. I took a guru, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, and he would send me to all these places. And so when I was sent to Australia, I enrolled in the Australian Conservatory there and did the same when I went to India. So basically, it was under the aegis of his instruction that I immersed myself in Sanskrit studies for 6 years.
I mean, you've lived such an amazing life, and read another story that, let me know if it's true or not, is that you started an animation studio with the Beatle George Harrison. Is that true?
It is partially. I mean, the origins of my, I was doing children's books in India and traveling around hiring Vedic artists. I mean, and these artists who, you know, have in the caste system were hired to paint these magnificent murals and sculptures for all of the Indian temples. Their family line goes back for centuries. So they've been trained for centuries in the whatever art that they were, you know, form of sacred art that they were doing. And so there was not a lot of work for them. And so I would go around and hire these artists to translate some of the great Sanskrit literatures and paint them. So I did a bunch of them. I have the story of Prahlad Maharaj and the King Ambarish. And in doing so, I thought, well, you know what, with all of these artists available so inexpensive, it would be ideal to start an animation studio there. And so I went around and speaking to a lot of the my guru's own, you know, financiers and patrons who were, you know, some of the wealthiest Indian industrialists, and broached the idea with them what it would be like. Now, at that time in India, it was the film industry was the largest in the world. And, you know, they would, you know, 500 million people would show up every week to go to the movie. And so, and they did these magnificent Bollywood spectacles. And a lot of them were based on the same, very same sort of literatures, the Mahabharata that I had been studying, the Ramayana. And so I thought, well, maybe that's what I'll do is just my first venture would be to animate the Ramayana, which is the story of Hanuman and Rama and Sita and their battle, an epic battle against Ravana, the 10-headed demon from Sri Lanka, Ceylon.
That's cool.
So I was really, really jazzed about that. It's a great, great myth. And in order to see previous portrayals of that or adaptations and gain kind of from lift it from the literature to the screen, I would start screening films in downtown Bombay. And I hired a screening studio there, and I don't know whether it was from the actual managers of the screening room, but I was screening a Bollywood production of the Ramayana, and George Harrison and Ravi Shankar showed up in the back of the theater. And so naturally, as I told them about my idea about doing an animation studio, and if I could ask them if I could look forward to their help. And they thought it was a great idea. George was in India then, just kind of, I think I had learned later that he left with something like 3 jumbo jets filled with artifacts and stuff.
Nice.
to decorate his house in London. And I think he was also, I mean, it was before Holy Grail. So he himself was just getting into film, handmade films was when he was going to start with Dennis O'Brien, his manager. And then by chance, at least this is how I remember it, he got, you know, he was able to put some money in along with Led Zeppelin and a few others. They all funded a Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And of course, it made such a fortune for them that they, you know, that George started handmade films and went on to do, I believe, The Life of Brian and then Time Bandits and all those sort of early Terry Gilliam pictures.
That is absolutely amazing. Just the fact that you can name drop so many awesome people is really impressive.
Well, I've, you know, had a lot of life to name drop.
And another thing that I think is absolutely fascinating is that, once again, you're so well traveled. You have you've had such an amazing background. Having been involved in so many different cultures, like they said, India, States, other places, at their core, is the basic mythology and ideas and stories the same at the very same level across cultures?
Well, I think you get into a gray area when you say they are the same because they're all so nuanced. But as you know, Jung would go on to say that there are, you know, that there are, or Joseph Campbell would go on to say that there are archetypes that are incredibly similar. And symbols, like, you know, just going on, the symbol of the world tree, you know, goes back to, you know, Inanna, and the idea of the god dying and rising again, you typically shedding their blood on the Axis Mundi, the world tree, and replenishing the earth. I mean, these go back, you know, go back to Neanderthalian stories of the bear caves, the high mountain bear caves, and they, where they had developed an elaborate belief system around burials, and the bones of people and animal were considered seeds. And so it was the planting of the seed in the ground would replenish life. And then, as we learn from the Ainu bear cult out of Hokkaido, Japan, you know, they believed very much, and these go back to the earliest beliefs of human kind, that spirits came from a lesser developed world than the spiritual world, and they would come visit here. And they would stay for a while in the particular, in the Ainu bear cults, which they trace it back, actually, Joe Campbell traces it back to Neanderthalian stories, the bear cave stories. They would actually take a bear cub, raise it, but, you know, in their family to play with their children. They would take him in, he would become a family member, and it was only until they became so, you know, threatening and rough as they grew, that they would separate them out, put them in a cage. And then, but they still lived with it, worshiped it. And then at the time that they felt was necessary, they would hold a big family ceremony, and they would pray to them. And there's, we actually have the actual prayers that they gave. This was going on, maybe even still going on, certain zip. But we have the prayers where they would say, you know, here's what's going to happen now. We're going to have to, it's time for you to return to your spirit world. So what we're, and this is the way, exactly the way we have to do it. But we hope we've treated you kindly enough, and that when you go back there, you'll tell others. And please, if you decide to ever visit, or friends of yours ever decide to visit again, you will be gracious and tell them how much we loved you. At which point they promptly cut their head off, sever their insides, take out all the meat, make a magnificent stew, and put the bear at the head of the table with flowers and candles and have this great feast and joy and merriment. And that's been going on for, you know, thousands of years. But in that, you see all of the sort of elements of, you know, the Eucharist, the baptism, the you know, the feast, the bloodshed, the spirit coming down to earth, everything that was in its earliest, crudest form in primitive times, you know, right on up to our earliest, or, you know, the most recent iterations of Christianity. And certainly in Hinduism, it's the same kind of the blood sacrifice of the spirit god, the spiritual world, all the same archetypes, but in so many myriad forms. There's another story of an eel, and it's a Polynesian tale of this magnificent, of this beautiful woman who would go and lie by this magnificent lagoon every day, where she would contemplate and read. And one day this magnificent moray eel swims up one of the back channels and comes into the river, to the lake, and transforms into this magnificent prince with a glorious headdress. And they became lovers. And this went on for every time she would go to the lagoon, the moray eel would swim up the channel, turn into this magnificent warrior prince, and then they would make love, and he would go turn back into an eel again and swim away until the next time that they rendezvoused.
Mm.
And at one point he comes to her and he says, you know, I'm not going to be able to come visit you anymore. And here's what I want you to do. When I turn back into an eel, I want you to cut off my head and plant it here on this spot where we've enjoyed so many beautiful points and times together. So she does that, and in that place grows the first coconut tree. And if you see in the orb of the coconut, there's two eyes and a mouth. Even to this day, I mean, you'll see it in an old coconut. And as a commemoration of this magnificent warrior priest. But once again, it's a totally different story, but you have the serpent, you have the tree, you have the beautiful, fertile virgin maid, you know, so that's how it's not the same, but, you know, these symbolic elements are all uniquely part of human awareness. We get that story sometimes just with even, you know, with not even knowing what we're looking at.
So when you're searching for a story or project to work on, being that you're so well-versed in these stories and these tropes, are you looking for those same core tropes in a project you're going to work on because you know those are the ones that are going to resonate?
Well, yes. Yes, yes. Mainly because it's what interests me. If there isn't that really core archetypal element to it, it's hard for me to, and I've had to learn that lesson the hard way, where I've signed on to a project because it was paying so well. And, you know, and I wanted to test my mettle and see where, you know, what other genres I could explore with. And if I don't find that ultimate archetypal core, it's, you know, to me, it's just, it's, I soon grow tired of it and bored, and there's nowhere for me to go with it. So essentially, yeah, what I'll look for is if I can delve deeply into that fathomless abyss of mythology, then that's then I'm a goner.
So when you first read The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle, what was it about that book that captured your imagination, and what do you think they would translate well into animation?
Well, you have to understand, back in that time, you know, everyone was getting out of the animation film business. Even Disney, and there was articles, I still have those articles, you know, even Disney was getting out. That was during the Ron Miller days, and Walt had passed away, and there's only one company in the world that could launch a successful animated film, and that was Walt Disney. And, you know, and it was waning and was expensive, and the old nine old men of the Disney animation studios were getting old and cantankerous, and so I think they were looking at facing the inevitability of the decline of animated film. So as for me, my love of animation was that it was like a portal into that spiritual realm, if you will, of another dimension that was not quite accessible in live action pictures, you know. And the CGI, certainly the special effects at that time were hardly impressive, although it was fun, you know, Ray Harryhausen and the Sinbad and the seven voyages of Sinbad. Those are all great fun, but you can still find that it was crude enough to where you couldn't really suspend disbelief, to the point where in animation, what I felt was it was just literally like a portal into another mythological realm of human awareness. And so and I could only describe that was my early love of certainly Disney animation, but then, you know, as I grew more sophisticated in that field, you know, other types of world animation. So literally when I came back to the United States, my big thing was I was going to set this company up and not just limit myself to doing Indian mythology, but also world mythology. Mm-hmm. And I was writing the Shah of Iran at that point, you know, because I wanted to do Mahmoud Faraz's illustrations, gorgeous stories of Scheherazade, and do animated versions of that. And so I was in New York meeting with Jack Zander, who had created Tom and Jerry, done some of the early Tom and Jerry animation. And he ran the most successful animation studio, commercial animation studio, in Manhattan. And they were doing really, you know, on the West Coast, you had Hanna-Barbera and Friz Freleng and DePatie Freleng. You had Lou Scheimer eventually doing He-Man. But it was all very, very limited animation. Mm. And because it was so expensive. However, in New York, there were these magnificent commercial animation houses doing full on 24 frames, you know, animation, like Claire Oliver Essence. Early Claire Oliver Essence, where this young maiden in a pond, you know, surrounded by this magnificent florid jungle. And then Lake Sheer Energy. And one of the top designers was a woman by the name of Keita Colton, beautiful, beautiful woman who I fell in love with. And I was telling her, you know, of course, my plans for India and the world. And she said, well, here's what you should do. And she gave me the last year.
That's awesome. So you became the associate producer of The Last Unicorn. What did this mean for your responsibilities for the film?
Well, the associate producer thing has always been sort of it's a rough thing. What happened was I optioned The Last Unicorn and then went on to found my own animation studio and was doing a bunch of commercials in the Midwest. And occasionally flying out to Los Angeles and meeting with all the studios trying to put the picture together there. But what I found out was that, you know, what is something you don't really, you're not really told about when you try to stick your toe in the film business is if they like the idea and you have the option, the biggest strategy is that they'll wait for the option to run out and then option it themselves.
Oh,
no. They know that you can't pour, you know, constant money into it.
Right.
So between the time that I was, you know, producing commercials, animated commercials in my studio, that's what I was finding. You know, I would go out and I would meet with everybody, but they would, you'd never hear back from them because they're waiting for the option to run out.
Oh, that sucks.
I know. It's one of the things you don't really learn about. But that's the cutthroat nature of the business. So what I found myself in a quandary that my option was running out. I had already spent, you know, I only had it for a year and a half. And so I had to either buy it outright, which nobody does, unless you're a big motion picture studio or a billionaire. And I had just done a series of commercials for a bank that won all kinds of awards. And when I went to them and I said, look, I want to buy the rights to this. So they gave me the equivalent of $198,000 to buy it outright so that no one could mess with me.
Very cool.
So getting back to a point that you said earlier, the thing that made me so convinced of this was the fact that it combined, you know, growing up Jewish and Jewish humor and my grandparents, which is all filtered throughout the entire book, but Peter's book, novel. And then also there's this kind of Eastern mysticism to it, because she's this eternal creature, unicorn, who gets turned into a human being. And you actually see her ontological existential challenge in how does she deal with being an eternal being in this physical body. And to me, it was so, so much a part of Eastern mysticism. So it was like the best of both worlds to have an Eastern, you know, mystical book with Jewish humor.
That's awesome.
And I thought that kind of was my own experience as well. So, you know, the book became a deep spiritual journey for me and a vocational one as well. So here I am. That convinced me to buy the rights to it. But then I got the hard lesson as I was deeply in debt, facing a industry that was looking to get out of animation. The only, other than even Disney films were terrible at that time. They were doing what the Fox and the Hound and Basil of Baker Street. But on the independent market, it was Richard Williams was doing Raggedy Ann and Andy. And another studio was doing Watership Down, Richard Adams' Watership Down. And they weren't doing terribly well. And they were all sort of, you know, there was just something strange. Either most people, if they heard animation around that time, they thought children. And if they thought animation, it was, you know, it's not such a great box office. You know, it's not worth the money. So the only people who were really doing anything interesting, like were Rankin Bass, which I really couldn't stand their animation, you know, just... And in fact, I vowed to Peter that they would be the last studios we would go to. And there's a funny little bit about that. But Disney called me out and they courted me. Then it just so happens that Warner Brothers was coming out with The Lord of the Rings by Ralph Bakshi. And Peter had done some screenwriting work on that, so they were aware of him. So right about the time that I showed up in Hollywood with the rights to The Last Unicorn, they were looking at the release of Lord of the Rings 6 months down the line. And if it went through the roof, they wanted to have a backup animated project to follow through with. And it just so happens that the coverage, the analyst coverage from Warner Brothers Studio was through the roof on The Last Unicorn, where they just said, it's so much better. This is the animated film of all time. We've got to do this film. And so I entered into a development deal with Warner Brothers, hugely lucrative. But Lord of the Rings came out. It was a massive failure from a lot of reasons. And the project went into turnaround. So now all of a sudden I'm bound to Warner Brothers. And the thing about turnaround in the motion picture business is they give you all this money, which is great, but you got to pay it back. And if you don't pay it back, they take the rights. So it was a glorious time until, you know, that the Lord of the Rings failed and the project goes into turnaround. Now all of a sudden, not only do I have the debt that of to the bank, but only like a year in which I had to change the dynamics. I had to, you know, make this film in a year's time. Otherwise, I would be, you know, the rights would go to Warner Brothers. So I was kind of backed into a corner. And one by one, I got turned down by all the studios, Disney. I was just at my wit's end. I went in to see my friend Marty Starger, who owned Marble Arch Productions with Lord Grade, and they had just done the Muppet movie. And they, Lord Grade, they owned ITV in London, and then Marble Arch was their American studio. And it was a startup motion picture studio. So I went in to see Marty with the rights to the last Unicorn, and he said to me, you know, Jules Bass was just here, and he was talking about this project. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because what was he doing pitching my project? But, you know, with all the creditors on my back and calling me, and all the studios had turned me down, I had one last resort to do, and that was to call Jules Bass and say, well, look, I understand that Starger, you just were with Starger pitching the last Unicorn. And so why don't we go into business and make the picture? And he said, great, let's do it. We made our deal, but the money up front didn't get me out of debt. And so I had to, at that point, just say, okay, you know, he actually offered me to direct the film. And I felt that the best position for me to make, you know, that best negotiation I could make was for more money if I took a lesser credit on the back end, then that would make me whole. So, and I thought, well, what the hell? It's my first motion picture anyway. So, so that's how I got the associate producer title. When, in fact, you know, I could have had, you know, any credit that I wanted to.
Well, I think one thing fascinating about The Last Unicorn is that even though it wasn't huge at the time, it's become a cult classic since.
Right.
And I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like Nightmare Before Christmas, that at the time it wasn't really that well thought of, but it's become such an important part of culture since. And the question is, how do you think culture has changed now that The Last Unicorn has found a home in this generation or current present time?
Well, one of the things that I found early on too, and one of my other reasons for making the picture was the appalling quality of storytelling in movies, especially animated, storytelling for movies, rarely had that deeper mythological archetypal level running through it. And you know, it was always the prince and the, you know, those are, you know, kind of superficial qualities to the fairy tale. And what I wanted to do was explore the mythological and more of a deeper yearning on through the characters, a deeper story that the Unicorn offered. And I also felt that it could become an homage to young girls and their yearnings, their deepest, most imaginations and wonderings. And it answered on a deep feminine quality. And there was a line from The Last Line of Faust that I absolutely loved. It's called, Das ewig weiblich seit uns hinan. The eternal feminine leads us onward. And I wanted to capture that in a motion picture for generations of young girls who, you know, were typically watching patriarchal pictures and you know, and suffering through it. And, but I saw that the Unicorn had that potential. And sure enough, it did. I mean, it was just I went to teach university years later, and you know, I found myself in a kind of Harrison Ford moment in, you know, where the whole lecture hall filled with young girls whose favorite film in the world was The Last Unicorn.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. Well,
you know that scene where Indiana Jones and his students batting her eyes when I love you.
Well, no word of a lie. Like I said, when I prepare for the interview, I decided to watch The Last Unicorn again, you know, because it's been a long time since I've seen it. And I decided, you know, I'm going to watch it with my wife. And my wife was like, which movie? I said, we're going to watch The Last Unicorn. She's like, holy shit, I love that movie. I watched the movie so many times growing up. She's like, oh yeah, I'm going to interview the associate producer, and I'm going to let you know I was the coolest husband for Lisa a couple of hours there.
That's true. You know, at the recent Academy screening in L.A., I was reunited with a bunch of my old screenwriting buddies from the animation days in the 80s. I ran CBS children's programming and was responsible for Pee-wee's Playhouse. But I also did, you know, I brought a lot of animation writer, Linda Wolverton, who went on to do Beauty and the Beast. Mm. Flint Dilley, who created Transformers and G.I. Joe, all the kind of geeky nerd boy films, whatever. Yeah. So anyway, so we were reunited at the Academy, and I'm being swarmed by all these beautiful female fans, and they were wearing like unicorn tapestry, and they got the whole deal going through. And I said, "See, Flint, you get all the geeky guys. I get all the beautiful girls."
That's awesome.
So it was a good player move.
Well, like I said, I'm quite cool right now to my wife. So I've been doing that for a while.
You could see it, by the way. I mean, the Academy screening was just absolutely magnificent. You know, I've seen so many iterations of it over the time that, you know, it never was released with its Dolby soundtrack. The images were, you know, just, you know, nowhere near as pristine and spectacular as they are now. It was like watching the film for the first time.
Oh, that's cool. Now, when you think about The Last Unicorn, you think back about it. If you were making it now, do you think that would be possible? Do you think today's studios would have allowed a movie like The Last Unicorn to follow through and get made?
It's, you know, there was something that we've often talked about, you know, Lauren Sands, who is Peter Beagle's manager, she runs Beagleverse right now. She's now right in the thick of it. And I think, you know, perhaps to a certain extent, Peter's fault, you know, as well. He always associated himself with really tough managers who were overly protective of him, and which is great, but it was not really conducive to business. And so at the time that I was there promoting The Last Unicorn, and we were in production with it, you know, I had, you know, McDonald's, I had this whole vision of merchandising that connection had not yet been made until 76, when George Lucas was the first to, you know, to merchandise Star Wars. But that was a really incredibly innovative and, you know, move, which is why he was able to take such a huge percent of it. And he just said, well, just give me the merchandising. So Alan Ladd and everybody thought, well, let's give this idiot the merchandising. You know, that's how little they thought of it. And in fact, Anthea Silbert, who was the head of Warner Brothers at the time, she looked at me and she goes, Michael, we're not in the merchandising business. So there was this whole, you know, it was before its time. And I think Peter, in that sense, it was very, very, very difficult, and there was a lot of kind of sabotaging going on that sort of prevented the film from at least taking off in the way that it could. So it, of course, bombed miserably. I was forced to, actually, here's an interesting story. So after going through all of this to finally get the film made, and you can divert me back to what your question was, but after the time of like this, you know, epic biblical ordeal of getting the picture made, nobody wanted to distribute it. You know, and of course I took it for granted. Of course somebody's, you know, I've gone through all this to get the film made and nobody wants to distribute it. That was to me such a shock. And I had to lift. And at that point, there were like two cans, about 150 pounds a piece. It was all, you know, celluloid. There was nothing digital at that time. So I would literally go around Hollywood with these two 300-pound cans and try to get people to watch the film. You know, and I'd like sit in the lobby of hotels if there was a big film festival going on or something, and just, you know, solicit distributors to take a look at my picture. So it, I was, the last resort was this film that had done, it was an offshoot company of Schick Sun Classic Films. I think they were like a Mormon company. All these cheesy little family films. And they were, they Jensen Farley. And so they basically just bought the film rights, you know, did the slash dap, god awful posters, released the picture, and then immediately went bankrupt. So it was an absolute disaster.
So it's kind of, I mean, your story of The Last Unicorn is very interesting. Like you said, it didn't do well at first. I mean, especially with the finances though, but it since has become, like as we mentioned earlier, such a classic. So when you're reflecting upon the movie, do you think of it as it's viewed now, or do you think of how it did at the when it first released, when you're kind of evaluating your decision to have done everything?
Well, I think, you know, I think you only have, like, you know, I only have a limited life to go on these epic journeys, and Unicorn took the wind out of my sails, I have to say. I'd given my life everything, risked everything. And to have it be such a bomb, and, you know, and then also to the same sort of insult to injury, being accredited as associate producer when, you know, you know, I gave my life's blood for it. There are a lot of these niggling little things that eat at me, you know, especially like at the nadir of my existence was walking through a Walmart and seeing this lousy video cassette with the god-awful imagery on it, and in a discount bin for $5. Oh. That was sort of the low point of it all. And I had so much passion, dreams, you know, and being way ahead of my time, it should have been a better outcome. And I think there is a kind of curse. We often talk about it, that there's a curse to the film that Lauren has been determined to turn around. And they seem to be doing very well with it. But, you know, it sort of took the wind out of my sails. It was, you know, a great disappointment. And it was one of those things, you know, I had to come to terms with either being ahead of my time or being a total failure. However, I was able to sort of, you know, redeem myself at CBS when I did Pee-wee's Playhouse. And that was there was also a bomb when it first came out. And then, you know, then over the 5 years became, you know, such a smash hit. And then, of course, he poor Paul gets, you know, caught in a nudie parlor somewhere and ruins everything. So yeah. I don't know whether that's part of, you know, is there is some sort of, you know, I have borne the burden of maybe being cursed.
but are the wounds healed by knowing now how much it means now for to so many people, and that is viewed now the way you viewed it when you were actually making it?
Yes. Oh God. Yeah. I have to say that I was not going to attend the Academy screening. You know, we'd done this on stage, you know, introduction with Peter and myself and Alan Arkin. And, but then, I was just going to bail out, but I decided, no, you know, let's to sit through it. And, it was just so gorgeous. Everything, the soundtrack, everything that was, you know, had been sort of like a little tinny, you know, chintzy kind of film had looked so glorious. The songs were magnificent. Peter's screenplay is just so eloquent and poetic. The acting is just stupendous. Just, you know, just every bit of it from Mia Farrow, Angela Lansbury. I mean, you're just in awe of the act, you know, the talent, the voice talent in it. It was just perfectly done. It couldn't have been any better. You know, maybe more fluid animation, but hell, we made the movie for $3.7 million. So, you know, that was a good budget for that time period. Mm. So, it was, again, I broke down sobbing at the end of the picture, and really felt like it had finally achieved its place in motion picture. It was glorious. It was timely. It was timeless. It holds up unbelievably. And then as the lights went up, this roaring ovation from the audience and people going, thank you, Michael. Thank you. Thank you. And that was really wonderful.
That's absolutely awesome.
It's not the best career path, you know, 40 years later.
Better late than never, though, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, well, now I can pass away. I can go to my grave a happy man.
so what's next for you?
Oh gosh, well, you know, I'm writing. I won the George Martin Award for a motion picture I wrote called Trapped in a Comic Book, where all of the characters from the golden era of comics come to life, and they leave the comic book world of Comictopia and come to their you know, Comictopia is invaded by the super arch villain, and there's nobody to save anyone because all the movie studios have bought up all the superheroes. so they come to the real life world and hire this sort of Seth Rogen, Zach Galifianakis, you know, crazy comic book graphic artist to help them. And he's just he's just devised this way for real life human beings to digitize themselves and enter back into the comic book world. So it's a whole glorious adventure of all of the great comics, you know, from Casper to Dick Tracy, everybody comes alive in an animated world.
Yeah.
And they go on this great adventure together. So that was a huge success screenwriting. And then George Martin gave me the best screenplay award for it. And so I all of a sudden, you know, just had a lot of projects being offered to me. And and right about, oh gosh, I did like four or five screens, just spent a couple of years after that award just doing nothing but writing eventually had a heart attack.
Oh no.
And so I said, well, maybe I better give this up, because I'm always so intense when I'm writing. It's just, you know, and it was hours and hours and hours a day. And so I laid off of that. And now I'm just kind of coming back around to I'm doing an adaptation of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which I'm really, really excited about. And very different from the Johnny Depp, Tim Burton. And again, it's you know, with that deep archetypal level. I have a script called The Mask of the Red Paw, which is a wonderful, wonderful, fully animated swashbuckling adventure set in '30s in Paris. And it's sort of a pair of, it's kind of Casablanca meets this, the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Very cool. Very cool.
And so I've got that script going. So yeah, I'm basically just writing and hoping that I can get a few of those made before I pass on.
Well, sir, I hope for the opportunity to go to see them, and you're welcome to come on the show anytime.
Great. Thank you.
And it was an absolute honor to talk with you. Like you said, I can brag to my wife when she comes home from work that this happened. So thank you so much, Mr. Walker.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
Totally my pleasure, sir. Have a fantastic night.
All righty. Hope I answered all your questions.
Totally did. Totally did. But like I said, anytime you want to come back, you can.
Okay, great. It'd be my pleasure too. Anytime you want me.